World Cup, World Cup. Every 4 years it's the World Cup, World Cup. If you don't pick up a grunt straight in the build-up, then we'll love it when you score a goal.
Ooh, did you see that?
World Cup, World Cup. It might all end in tears or a headbutt. You can follow all the blogging on your laptop. From Slovenia to Slovakia, from Nigeria to the Cote d'Ivoire.
Ooh, Cote d'Ivoire.
The Guardian and Observer, packed with World Cup coverage every day.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we get to grips with the latest launch news from the biggest tech company on the planet, Apple Inc. Plus, we'll be issuing a call for web-savvy revolutionaries to take the latest tranche of government data released online and create something spectacular out of it.
The situation right now is the data's out there, but most citizens on the street, so to speak, can't use it. I mean, they need to be a programmer or they need to surf through it in great detail actually to be able to do anything meaningful.
That was Conrad Wolfram of Wolfram Alpha talking about the release of the Combined Online Information System, or COINS data, the largest government accounting database ever to be made available to the public. We'll be discussing whether this is a win for the Free Our Data campaign later, and also hearing from Conrad about how a search on his computational knowledge engine, which is what they call it, is different to a search on Google. We'll also be finding out what dangers lie beneath telling your Facebook friends that you like something. A new phenomenon known as likejacking has the potential to create a spam monster larger even than the scam industry that currently weighs down your inbox. Joining me to discuss the implications of these technology stories are Charles Arthur, the Guardian technology editor, and Tom Watson, Labour MP for West Bromwich, and a fierce data campaigner when he was inside the cabinet under the Labour government. Welcome, Tom. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi.
Tom, you were instrumental in bringing data, bringing public data, and helping government to understand that it needed to be released to the public. How does it feel now that it seems to have come to pass?
It's really rewarding and very exciting. You know, we're kind of just on the cusp of something great, I think. And, I sometimes think that the politicians that are doing it don't quite understand the power of what they're doing, which is why we're getting them to do it. But, the COINS released last week was fabulous to see, and I think will make a huge difference in years to come.
Well, we'll be talking more about that. But tell me, just briefly, is this the pinnacle of your political career thus far?
It probably is thus far. It's certainly the most radical thing I've been involved in, and I think it will change the way government operates forever. So, yeah, I feel very proud to be part of it.
Now, Charles, you've been working towards this goal from the outside. You've been campaigning for free data for years. But now that we can access everything from free maps to, you know, how much consultants cost the public purse, what do you plan to do with it? Well, I mean, now that you have access to it, what are you going to do with it?
There's a huge business opportunity actually out there for developers to create businesses which analyze all this data and actually turn it into something that's useful for the citizen, because there's so much data out there, you can't make sense of it if you don't apply a computer to it. But having the skills to really make sense out of it and the skills to know what to put together, that's the sort of thing that there's a real huge business opportunity.
You're pretty handy with a computer yourself, Charles. I've seen your spreadsheets and your data crunching, so is this in your future?
Say spreadsheets. Spreadsheets are evil.
Oh,
databases, they're the good ones.
Well, we can deal with this offline, Charles, but we'll have more on the COINS data and the other successes in the open data movement later in the podcast, so keep listening to Tech Weekly. First up, Apple hosted its annual Worldwide Developers Launch announcement this week, revealing to the world what we already knew was coming.
For 2010, we're going to take the biggest leap since the original iPhone. And so today, we're introducing iPhone 4, the fourth generation iPhone.
Steve Jobs launching the latest iPhone hardware. It wasn't much of a surprise, to be honest, given the high-profile leak of a phone in a downtown bar in San Francisco a few weeks ago. We found out, however, from the announcement that the device has a faster processor, a built-in flash. But the big reveal at the end of the two-hour keynote speech was Jobs' announcement of a video chat on the phone via a front-facing camera. So, Charles, where does this announcement take us? Is there anything new or unexpected? Anything that's a game-changer here?
The new screen on the iPhone 4, which has, in effect, four times as many pixels in the same space, which people who've had hands-on say that it's very, very impressive. And Jobs was saying it's sort of book quality in terms of the pixels per inch. It's above 300 pixels per inch. When you get to that sort of level of screen density, of pixel density, then it's as good as reading text on a page. When you get to doing that, then actually you can start to replace books, because the problem's always been with screen reading that you read on a screen, on a computer screen, you know, sounds computer screen, you only read half as fast there as you do off a page. So with the iPhone, and especially with the announcement he also made in the speech about moving the iBooks platform onto the new iPhone, I see that as being a real move by Jobs to get into the ebooks market, to start to corner that, because he also said about how five out of six publishers say they've got 22% already, just with the iPad, which is only launched in April, of the ebooks market. And that compares to Amazon, which has been pushing the Kindle forever, but will never give us numbers. So you could imagine that possibly in a couple of years, once screen prices come down far enough, that you'd have a really detailed version of the iPad, which would then be a real ebook reader, and when that starts to happen, well, you know, that I think that's when you get into real game-changing stuff.
Tom, recently Steve Jobs spoke at the D8 summit as well, and he offered his thoughts on the future. He was adamant that he wants to get content off devices, whether it's off phones, off PCs or desktop computers, even off laptops. But given Apple's prior reluctance to open up their own content, and, you know, to share with other providers, how likely is it that we'll see an Apple hardware product support things like file sharing or exchange of non-proprietary tech?
Well, this is the first big launch where I've talked to people in my digital community who say they've had it with Apple. You know, they say he's gone too far, he's closed this down. So I do think it's sort of harming his brand and sort of arresting that poor journalist who happened to get a phone that was left in a bar, I think has really done them damage. So I'm not sure where it will go. I mean, we know that philosophically that when you've got an open culture, then great things happen, you get innovation. So, I mean, Apple have always managed to be immensely innovative and a very secretive and closed organisation. I'm not sure if they can do that forever. And certainly the people that I know are sort of beginning to think, oh, is this just more hype, you know? And so we'll see where it goes. But this is, I mean, and I am an Apple lover. I'm a sort of, you know, a geek kid for Apple. But I can just sense that their brand is diminishing as the sort of, they turn themselves into a big publishing empire.
Charles, we mentioned briefly that the iPhone 4 was leaked. Or perhaps not leaked, it was accidentally left in a bar where a journalist could pick it up.
Yeah, man walks into a bar.
Yeah, sees iPhone prototype.
A lot of things were known about it. The detail about the screen had been leaking out through other venues, and the disassembly that Gizmodo did and Jason Chen did didn't quite get into that detail because the phone had been deactivated, wouldn't power up. But yeah, we did know a lot about it.
Is this going to affect Apple's approach to release to the market in the future?
These things have happened from time to time. I mean, there are always little channels and ways that this stuff leaks out. I mean, you know, if you've been following, I've been following, you know, Apple for 15 years or something. Ever since Steve Jobs came back, he really closed it down. He's very much of the loose lips sink ships sort of school of thinking. Details always leak out one way or another. People put together a picture, which has become much easier with the web. And it's not as if this has never, ever happened before. And as far as phone testing goes, as Jobs said at the D8 conference, you know, actually you do have to take these things off campus and try them out.
Finally, there was also some upsetting news that Apple had to deal with over the past few weeks. The company that puts their products together in China, Foxconn, experienced several suicides. And how do you think that this is, Tom? How much do you think that this is going to affect Apple's reputation?
It depends how they deal with it. I mean, they've obviously sort of increased wages overnight, but the labor unions in the States, is a very powerful website called laborstart.org, seized on this and used the sort of Apple brand as political leverage and held them to ransom a little bit. I mean, if Apple are sensible, they'll talk to their friends in Washington about how you can build labor rights in China across the piece, because it's not just them as a tech company that are affected by this. You know, when you're building huge technology villages of 500,000 people living in dormitories, it's a kind of new Victorian age in China, and the challenge is for them to play a corporately social socially responsible role, and they can get hold of it and deal with it. Otherwise, it's going to trouble them for years to come, I think.
You have to translate the lyrics of Jerusalem into Chinese, won't you? I mean, Foxconn obviously doesn't only assemble Apple gear, but Apple is certainly the highest profile company that that it does stuff for.
Yeah.
Well, in other technology news, Facebook, the poor maligned Facebook at the minute, they rolled out a feature that allows people to tell their Facebook friends when they like something, a site, an image, or a video anywhere else on the web. Clicking like next to any web content would automatically create an entry on your profile's news feed, alerting your connections and providing a link to the content's address. Now, a very clever way of integrating the rest of the web, and ensuring that Facebook continues to be relevant. Or was it a short-sighted solution that leaves users open to a new kind of fraud, which is colloquially known as likejacking? Charles, tell me a little bit more about what's going on here.
Well, pretty much as soon as Facebook put out this the like button, which can be implemented with a few lines of code on any website, people who are of a any hacker started thinking, hey, I bet you could use this too, ... And a few examples started popping up of people saying, hey, I can make this appear in everyone's newsfeed. Less well-disposed people started using it and putting the live frames, which is just a little piece of code which can be invisible over the like button. And when you click that, it actually fed, that was in effect the like button, which fed back to your newsfeed and put it out. So without realizing that you'd liked something, you had liked it. The trouble being that what the scammers can do next would be to have a real like button on a page, but have the iframe linking to malware, which is something which happens quite a lot already on other pages. So it's the sort of thing that happens when you have a very trusting company which thinks that everyone has the best possible motives. It's the best possible world sort of scenario. And one gets the impression that Mark Zuckerberg is a bit like this.
Well, he is only 12.
I mean, it reminds me a bit, actually, of Bill Gates and his approach, which was that, Windows... certainly through to Windows 95, especially because that was pretty much an offline operating system, and sort of got dragged onto the internet just at the end of its development, was a very trusting system. It was sort of, hey, you're on the internet, I'm on the internet, that's really great. And so, pretty much anything could take control of Windows 95, and to some extent Windows XP, that was still a very trusting system. Didn't have the firewall turned on by default, had a backdoor administrator account, all those sorts of things. So Zuckerberg talks about the web all being interconnected and everything being connected, and you can't tell when you're on Facebook and when you're not on Facebook. And you think, Mark, yeah, that's good, but actually there are nasty people out there who want to take all your money and, burn your house down as well. So one gets the feeling that Facebook might have to go and revisit this.
What do people have to look out for? Because this isn't just a Facebook thing, is it? It's the iframes phenomenon is something that exists already.
Yeah, the trouble with iframes is that they can get loaded from anywhere and you don't know it's happening. It's a piece of browser legacy, in effect, which can be useful, but which can also be used for bad effects. So there have been sort of adware attacks where a reputable website, so the New York Times got hit, will be serving up adverts which in themselves contain iframes which link to malware, and people can get hit like that. So it's rather difficult actually to know what to do. The only way you can protect against it is to turn off JavaScript in your browser, but if you do that, then most of the web stops working as it should these days.
Tom, how much do you think this is going to affect Facebook's reputation? We spoke earlier about the idea of Zuckerberg, kind of losing face a little bit when it came to newsfeed. Back in the day when it was first implemented, there was a huge outcry and suddenly people were saying privacy, privacy, and clearly they're having privacy issues now. But in the end, people adopted Zuckerberg's folly. They adopted newsfeed. They said, this is fantastic. Is this something that's going to happen again?
Well, with Facebook, they've got a kind of reputation now for sort of doing things new, just sticking it out there and then sort of riding the waves of reaction. And provided they listen and try and put things right quickly, then I think they'll be okay. They got hit on the privacy stuff because they didn't respond to their users quickly enough, and it did create an outcry and all sorts of people saying, that's it with me and Facebook. On this one, it's a technical problem. I think people will forgive them. After all, they're trying to do the right thing because they're trying to get into the weave of the net and allow people to do what they do innately, which is share content they enjoy with the people they like. But if they don't put it right, I think it'll just make Facebook impossible to use, so they've got to deal with it quickly.
Well, that's all the news for the moment. We'll be talking about the release of the government's coins data later on in the program. But for the moment, you can see all the other news from the last 7 days in tech at guardian.co.uk/technology. Last year, the technology world watched with a combination of fascination and trepidation as an unknown product launched itself on the search engine scene. This attempt at creating a rival to Google was different enough to garner a lot of attention. The so-called Knowledge Engine was created by Conrad Wolfram, and his team was a group of highly skilled data-crunching engineers who were already well-known for their technological program Mathematica. The search engine was called Wolfram Alpha. Crucially, this engine uses data as its starting point, not keywords embedded in web pages like Google and her competitors. The data-driven process represents a paradigm shift in this industry and emphasizes the importance of data openness. Charles Arthur met with Conrad Wolfram last week, and he asked him to tell us how Wolfram Alpha is different from Google.
We have a very different process. We're sucking in knowledge up front and making it computable, as we call it. And then we're understanding the query, which you type in a way that looks a little similar to a search engine, but we're trying to understand the meaning of that. And then we're using computation to get between the knowledge we have and the answer that you want. And that's the kind of glue in the middle of those. And so over the year, we've been really improving all ends of that, working with a lot of data providers, particularly governments, to make their data accessible in a good form that can easily be sucked in and worked with, and at the other end, improving our capabilities at computing the results. And a part of that is also including human experts in each field so that they can inform, in a sense, what kinds of things you want to see. Because even if you're querying information of some sort, you may not know exactly what it is you ideally want to see about that. You just know you want to compare two companies, for example, or you want to see the environmental impact of different countries' CO2 outputs, for example. But you may not want to know all the parameters you want inside that. So that's another area we've been working heavily on.
So it sounds as though you don't try to crawl the whole of the web in the way that, say, Microsoft or Bing might want to, that you would rather go for trusted sources where you're getting data rather than a whole lot of words about things.
Absolutely. So we're very much on what we call systematic knowledge, end of the spectrum. We're not looking at opinion per se as such. Obviously, there's a somewhat fuzzy line between those, but that's very much the end we're working from. No, we don't crawl the web sort of, you know, raw at all. We everything that's in Wolfram Alpha has somehow been curated by a mixture of manual and automated process, so that we hope we'll, you know, one, of course, benefit of that is we hope we have really quite accurate results for things that come out. But another benefit is the fact that we can set automation when you do a query in real time onto working out new results, maybe results that nobody's ever computed before.
How important is Mathematica? Because people who know the Wolfram name will be familiar with Mathematica, which is used by engineers and mathematicians all over the world, even if it's not seen by the majority of consumers.
We could not have built Wolfram Alpha without Mathematica. One of the things we've been doing in Mathematica over the years is to build up automation in it, so that the sort of, you know, the computation that you're doing or it's doing is quite separated from what you're asking it to do. You know, there's a big automation layer there, and Wolfram Alpha is another layer on top of that, essentially. The other thing is just in the style of programming, and the fact Mathematica is very much a language, and I think the current score is we're up to about 8 million lines of code written in Mathematica. So in a sense, Wolfram Alpha is an application of Mathematica. And we reckon that would have been 300-400 million lines of code in a traditional language, which is pretty much impossible. I mean, that's way above, you know, the size of Windows, for example. So in both of those ways, and of course its computational abilities, which have been critical. And there's a fourth way, actually, that's quite interesting, which is the idea that you can pump out sort of real-time formulated documents that come straight out and are sort of made in real time, and that also moves towards applications that can be pumped out in real time and made. That was a facet of Mathematica further developed for Wolfram Alpha that sort of made this possible.
What's the commercial model? How do you make it pay?
There are several different models, and it's been a sort of amusing debate in the company as to which wins first, so to speak. Certainly there are things around the website itself, you know, including in the future API and other models, and also partnering, for example, with Bing.
And where Bing pays you money.
Indeed, yeah.
And you would charge for the API.
We'll charge commercially. You know, the model for that's still being worked out. And we're very much wanting to make this a very mass use tool. So we're going to be pretty aggressive with the pricing on that. But yeah, the idea is if you're commercial, you'll pay for that. If you're not, you won't. And you can just use it. And that's sort of the model we're looking at the moment for the API and the widget builder that will go along with that to make it easy to use. And also, we've had a huge interest in people using the technology we've got and the curation ideas on their own sort of private information inside a company, for example.
So companies want to use your systems to analyze their own information.
They say it because, you know, you want to ask questions like, what was the Guardian circulation 2 months ago as a linguistic question. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily want to go down a big chart and look at that, which is the traditional way people look at reports in organizations. Yeah. And so, of course, a lot of this also feeds into some of the work that's being done in government, particularly in the UK at the moment, as to, you know, how you should look at information and be able to work with that effectively.
We're speaking just as the government has released its COINS database. You think that we're really only on the first step, that sort of release is enough. Why is that?
I think there's a big difference between making data available and democratizing it. Making it available, which is a great important start, of course, you know, is making sure that, you know, that it's technically out there, that there is data. The question is what format it's in and whether you can immediately work from it. And, you know, the situation right now is the data is out there, but most citizens on the street, so to speak, can't use it. I mean, they need to be a programmer or they need to surf through it in great detail actually to be able to do anything meaningful with it. We're trying to deal with that gap. What I understand Cameron's vision to be of citizens holding the government to account on their information, I think this is a critical part of achieving that aim.
I mean, the government is aiming to be in power in this parliament for 5 years. Do you think that's a long enough time frame?
Oh, absolutely. I see no reason why it can't happen. I mean, it depends, of course, what one's defining it as being. But I mean, I think to get a very meaningful set of results for both, you know, national and local information. I mean, for example, in the US, we've recently added some crime data. So you can compare crime rates for burglary between different cities. You know, that's already there and available. It's a question of just scaling it up and making it work in the UK.
Charles Arthur speaking with Conrad Wolfram. Now, Charles, data-driven solutions often suffer from the absence of human intervention. You know, they don't necessarily reflect actual behavior. They reflect what the computer says. And, you know, computer says no, computer says yes, whatever. Does Wolfram Alpha actually work? And if it does, how does it compare with other search engines in terms of results?
It does work. It's very good. You could think of it as being quirky, but for example, a couple of weeks ago when it looked like Apple's market capitalization was going to pass that of Microsoft, you could actually find out from Wolfram Alpha with a single query what the comparative capitalizations were. You just put AAPL, which is Apple's stock ticker symbol, and MSFT into it, and it would come up with the comparative market capitalizations, number of staff, profits for the last year, all sorts of details about them. So it's, in that sense, it's a data-driven search engine. If you go and ask it, Steve Jobs, how many iPhones sold, it will go, it'll sort of go, well, I don't really understand that question.
Well, what about, you know, best breakfast in London?
Again, that's not the sort of thing because, you know, best, well, you know, define best. Do you mean the crunchiest croissants?
Or
do you
mean the biggest amount of...
This is the thing is, you know, that's a very qualitative thing. And what the Wolfram Alpha system is really good at is quantitative. So it's quirky, but I think it's really interesting. And all the sorts of work that they're looking at doing, things like widgets and the API and so on, I think is very, very interesting.
Now, you mentioned the API and the widgets and those types of things. They're also looking, as Wolfram mentioned, that they're licensing things out to Bing, for example. Is this a business solution or is this a business model that you think will sustain it, that will work?
I think that, yeah, they can. The licensing deal with Bing is the sort of thing that that will keep it running. And Mathematica, which is a separate company, that's Wolfram Research. Wolfram Alpha is a separate company which does the search engine. Mathematica actually powers and feeds into the Wolfram Alpha search engine. So my understanding is that Wolfram Alpha, you know, pretty much covers its costs, that there's a lot of potential for making money, that you know, once you get into this data explosion which is coming, you're going to want to have more search engines which will do this sort of analysis for you.
It sounds like it's very, very useful for something like academic research. When I look back to what I was doing, I would have had to have paid a phenomenal amount of money for any kind of database query program or have something built to bespoke. And so this seems like a solution that, you know, you could put data. Would it have to be public data? So it would have to actually tap into a public data repository.
It has to be able to tap, yeah, it has to be able to access the data. It has to have the data, and the data tends to get curated as well by people. But once you've done that, then it can start to pull it in.
Now, Tom, for Wolfram Alpha to work, it demands large open data sets. And you've been instrumental in bringing large open government data sets to the public, making them open and accessible. But at the same time, commercially, what would happen if suddenly, for whatever reason, political or social or cultural, government decided to close down those databases, bring them back to their chests? What would happen to an organization like Wolfram Alpha or any of the other organizations that are increasingly going to start working with and using the open data sets?
We've already seen over the last decade 1,000 good ideas wasted because government hadn't released the data. So, I mean, it would close down innovation straight away. It would mean that people knocking at the door of government with good ideas for how we can make better public services would just go away. So, I mean, we know that when the data is released, it stimulates massive innovation in a way that you can't possibly manage from the centre of government. So it would be a disaster. However, I don't think we can put the genie back in the bottle now, because once the data is released, to try and take it back, you'd have civil unrest, I suspect, amongst the geeks out there who've been crunching it for years. So, you know, that's the lesson for politicians. You know, once you go down this road, you can't get back. It's not a question of letting go. You let go forever. It's the exciting thing and slightly scary thing about being in the ministerial seat when you do that.
Well, it's an absolutely terrifying thing, and I'd love to know about those late night conversations when you were trying to convince people, no, it's a great idea for you to just, you know, expose everything to the public. What hoops did you have to jump through in order to convince people of this?
Well, I certainly, there were some days I realised the sort of magnitude of what we were doing, but tried to sort of hide that from the people I needed to convince to let the data go. There's certainly an institutional response to data release that I sort of say there's a sort of 6-point plan. First, you have the denial that the minister is asking for this stuff. Then you have the resistance. Then you have the moral panic when they sort of realise you're serious. And then after the release, you have the kind of outrage that this stuff has been given away and it's out there. Then there's a period of reflection. And then finally, you get to the point where there's innovation. And that's where success has 1,000 fathers and mothers, and everyone says it was their idea and what a great initiative it is. And, you know, I'm really pleased to see that David Cameron has stamped his leadership over this agenda as well, because there is still that resistance in other parts of the government estate, and unless the sort of corporate core says this is going to happen, it just, you know, there's all those hurdles you have to get over. And we saw with the coins release that it actually took a prime ministerial announcement to make it happen.
Well, it's very big of you to say, Tom, as a Labour MP, that you think it's great that the Conservative leader has put their stamp on it. I mean, how does it feel? Do you feel as if, you know, all the mothers and the fathers and the aunts and the uncles and everybody's coming out of the woodwork to say this was my idea, when in fact you were pretty...
There's a bit
pretty
of that. But I think if you're in this agenda, you can't, you can't get, because it's actually not about ownership. It's about giving ownership away. So, I mean, there's always the political parties try and row about this agenda. You know, the Tories call it the sort of post-bureaucratic age, and my side would call it the sort of next iteration of the responsive state. You know, the truth is, it's just a good idea whose age has come from the role of the opposition backbenchers. I want to be supporting the government in this agenda and pressuring them to do things quicker and deeper and faster. You know, we've now got some digital natives who were elected 3 weeks ago. they get this agenda innately, and they're going to sort of put the pressure on to make sure it happens as well. So, you know, it's really exciting.
It is a very interesting cultural shift that's happening in government, because it is people who do understand technology. And in fact, there were a few of us who were posing the question of whether Nick Clegg and David Cameron grew up with computer games. And if that's the case, then we have finally arrived.
Well, there is that kind of generation of people in their early 40s. You know, I think Nick Clegg's a day older than me, you know. So he is definitely the Sinclair Spectrum generation. I'm sure he's played Manic Miner. I'm not sure whether David did at Eton, but I mean, you know, that kind of there's a cultural sort of shift with those guys.
In terms of the cultural shift associated with opening up data, because that really is, that is something that is breaking down those hierarchies. Can you tell me a little bit about this the resistance stage and maybe even give some examples of how you had to battle through that, what you used, what techniques you used to convince people that this was a good idea?
Well, I mean, the classic example is Ordnance Survey. I tried persuasion, I tried gentle persuasion, I tried to sort of encourage. And in the end, it just really took being unspeakably rude and brutish to get things done, you know. And we had a classic example where the Bramley Women's Institute were prohibited from using an OS map on their website because they had the potential to be a revenue-raising institution. And, you know, when you look at how silly and anachronistic that view was, you know, we just had to take it head on. And I was very fortunate that I worked with Ed Miliband and Liam Byrne, who understood this agenda as well, and they helped build an alliance across government to sort of mean that, you know, the Prime Minister announced that he would let the OS data go. And that was a totemic release, I think. But there's still lots to come, you know. I mean, I don't know why companies' house data is not available for people to use. But once you've gone through the big one, and geospatial data was definitely the big one for me, then I think the others will follow through.
Technology was a pretty important part of the campaign agenda. So given that now that we have a coalition government with potentially different approaches to technology, to privacy, to openness of data, what do you think they should tackle first?
Well, they've done the big stuff. You know, they're scrapping ID cards. They're sort of telling the big systems integrators they've got to cut their budgets. I know I was talking to representatives of some of the big providers who were told they're expecting very tough conversations with ministers who want to drive down their costs. But, you know, to get the cultural change, I think they've just got to learn from the data mashers. You know, they've got to sort of think small, test these things out. If it works, iterate, and then scale it. You know, and they kind of know philosophically that's the way you're going to stimulate innovation and provide more and better public services. You know, the expectation of government is that they provide public services at pinpoint accuracy, at a scale that affects every citizen on day one of launch. There isn't an IT provider in the land that can do that in the commercial sector. So I think, you know, we've just got to get the cultural sort of change where people are rewarded for innovation and not punished if they failed. You know, if they fail persistently, maybe. But, you know, the way ministers work, they're on a short time span. You know, if they want success in the first 12 months before they get promoted, it's quite hard for the civil service to take that longer view. I remember challenging the DCSF, the schools ministry, when they on a day when I couldn't take my kids to school because it was snowing. And I posted on Twitter, you know, where is the website that allows parents to tell me whether the school is closed this morning so I don't have to walk to school in a blizzard? And within 24 hours, the innovation team at DirectGov, led by a guy called Paul Clark, had come up with a prototype that subsequently didn't see the light of day because officials at the DCSF were worried about X, Y, and Z, and it didn't happen. But, you know, that is where we've got to be, and we've got to find the intrapreneurs within institutions and encourage them to go out there and think about how we can use this data more efficiently.
That is a real cultural shift, though, within government.
It's hard, but, you know, you build these things steadily, you know, and, you know, you celebrate success and reward people who've got good ideas and, you know, let people down gently when they've made a mistake. You know, you can do it, but it does take leadership and it does take, it takes an understanding of the way the digital world works to get it right, I think.
Well, you can follow what happens with the new government's technology policies and how open they are with their data at guardian.co.uk/technology. And you can give Wolfram Alpha a go at wolframalpha.com. That's it for this week. Many thanks to our studio guests, Tom Watson and Charles Arthur. Our producer today was Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Kratosky. Now, I'm away next week, but the show will go on when I think Jemima Kish will be stepping into my shoes. In the meantime, though, keep your eyes peeled on guardian.co.uk/technology and let us know what you want to hear on our Twitter feed at GuardianTW. I'm back in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.